host Chris for The Witching Hour live on CFRC 101.9 FM every Wednesday at 12 a.m., where you can get your weekly dose of metalcore, post-hardcore, crying, screaming, and sometimes throwing up.
Oh my God! Oh my God!
They say nothing good happens after midnight, but why not stay a while and find out?
You're listening to Kingston's only campus community radio station, broadcasting 24/7, 365 on 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Tune in for the best local programming.
The following program is an all-language show which includes open discussions on topics related to the LGBTQ plus community and beyond, including, but not limited to, mature subject matter such as sex and sexuality, personal experiences, and more. We aim to create a respectful and inclusive space for all. Listener discretion is advised. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the producers and this outlet. Stay tuned for thought-provoking conversations and so much more.
Hi, everybody. This is Gino Vanelli. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
With the 50th edition of the Toronto International Film Festival just around the corner, today on Rainbow Country, I thought I would spotlight two films that were part of TIFF 2024. Sweet Angel Baby and Are You Scared to Be Yourself Because You Think That You Might Fail? That and more next. So stay tuned. The Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, this is Emily Saliers from Indigo Girls.
Hey everyone, this is Chris Harder, porn star, burlesque performer, and the creator of Porn to Be a Star. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Well, hello, and welcome to a brand new journey through Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. And as always, I am your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. By the way, Rainbow Country originates from CIUT-FM in Toronto, and now proudly in syndication across Canada. And it's also a number one Canadian LGBT podcast. And that is thanks to you tuning in, streaming, downloading, but ultimately listening. So today, with the 50th edition of the Toronto International Film Festival just around the corner, on this episode, I'm spotlighting two Canadian queer films that were part of TIFF 2024. Sweet Angel Baby, the award-winning film from Canadian filmmaker Melanie Oates, joins me in a recent interview to talk about Sweet Angel Baby's current Canadian theatrical release, her experience at TIFF 2024, and more. Plus, in hour two, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. And on this episode, I'm featuring some classic disco, some Canadian indie, and more. All that lies ahead as we start this journey through Rainbow Country. And our first stop, the Rainbow Country Bookstore. Today, award-winning best-selling author Michael Bach reads from his latest book, Alphabet Soup, The Essential Guide to LGBTQ2+ Inclusion at Work.
Alphabet Soup is a guide that will take you, my faithful reader, on a journey of discovery with the objective of turning you and your organization into active allies, a term I explain in the book. Like it or not, LGBTQ2+ people need allies to help us achieve that elusive goal of true inclusion. Everything in this book can be applied to a workplace and engaging with employees, as well as interactions with volunteers, customers, students, parishioners, or just everyday people on the street. When it comes to LGBTQ2+ inclusion at work and in communities, I'm always reminded of one of my favorite conversations. Many years ago, I was speaking with the head of HR for an organization located in a Western European country that shall remain nameless to protect the guilty. She was telling me about the company's work in diversity and inclusion, with no mention of work in the LGBTQ2+ communities. When I probed, she defensively explained that they don't discuss, quote, these things, end quote, at work. I looked over at a photo on her desk and asked if the man in it with her was her husband, to which she responded in the affirmative. It was a wedding photo and she was wearing a white wedding dress, so chances were good. I pointed out that the photo was a statement of her sexual orientation. I likely didn't need to ask her what sexual orientation she identified with because she had it on display. I probably should have asked, but let's focus on the point. That was an eye-opening moment for her. Organizations don't think about how much it costs to not create inclusive space for LGBTQ2+ folks, but the price tag can be quite hefty. There's the cost of lower levels of engagement, the cost of higher levels of voluntary turnover, the cost of recruitment, the cost of decreased innovation. And just like when I enter a wine store, that bill can add up fast. So how do you quantify the cost? I spent a lot of time trying to figure that out. Then, around 2005, someone from IBM shared a model with me. The first time I saw it, I thought, this is exactly what I've been trying to explain. And I used it to build a business case for why my employer needed an LGBTQ2+ employee resource group. At the top of the list of issues is the fact that the approach to educating on diversity and inclusion is traditionally one and done. You put everyone through a voluntary program and you're good, right? This is what I like to refer to as wrong. The first mistake is that your employee population isn't static. The average employee turnover rate is about 18%, but that can be a lot higher in some industries like food service or retail. One food service employer I worked with had a turnover rate of nearly 75% of frontline workers. By the time you've trained everyone, you need to start back at the beginning to capture new people. And that cycle continues endlessly. Education should be part of onboarding. From the day a person starts, there should be mandatory D&I education, obviously with specific LGBTQ2+ content, driven by a D&I learning map that takes each person through a learning journey. The second mistake in the one-and-done approach is the idea that one program covers it all. If Black Lives Matter has shown us anything, it's that we have a lot of work to do to educate people on anti-Black and anti-Indigenous systemic racism. And that's just one topic. The conversation on LGBTQ2+ inclusion is constantly evolving, and so should your education program.
When I return, my TIFF 2024 on-location interview with award-winning filmmaker Beck Pico, who talks about their award-winning trans short film, Are You Scared to Be Yourself Because You Think That You Might Fail?
Hi, I'm Keegan Hurst, former professional rugby player, coach, raving homosexual, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tarrant.
Are you okay? I'm like really nervous. Are you nervous?
No.
You smell crazy.
Oh my god. That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Oh,
so weird. I had no idea what I was going to look like.
What do you think I was going to look like?
just like no goose.
They'll be back tomorrow.
I want to go home. Just for like a few days.
A few days?
I can't do nothing with my T-Rex arms.
You know who really wants to help?
Your mom wants to help.
Beck Pico, hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I am good, I am good. We are here on location during TIFF 2024. It's the 49th edition of the Toronto International Film Festival. You have a film that's part of the festival, a short. First of all, how has your TIFF experience been so far?
So far, it's been great. I mean, I've only seen three films, but because I'm working during the day, so I have to only go at night. But yeah, you know, it's I try to get to TIFF every year, so, and I try to see as many films as I can, and I just kind of let go and see what comes my way, you know. And sometimes you're like, that was amazing, and sometimes you're like, I don't know what I just saw, but but both are interesting experiences.
But you are part of the festival officially, so has it changed for you compared to other years you've been here?
Well, yeah, now I have a little card around my neck, okay. Which I'm proud of,
okay.
But still just a guest pass. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure everyone says that, but this is like a total dream of mine, because I've been coming to the festival since I was a kid, growing up in Toronto, and I've always, like, yeah, when I was like 12 years old, I was like, I want to have film at Toronto Film Festival, and I had submitted films before, so, you know, it feels like a big deal for me, but it's also a bit surreal, because it also just feels like TIFF.
And 2024 mm-hmm. is your year, so you have a short film. And it's called, Are You Scared to Be Yourself Because You Think That You Might Fail?
Yes.
That's the title.
Yes.
Are You Scared to Be Yourself Because You Think That You Might Fail? You wrote this, you directed this. It's a short, about 20 minutes, a shy of 20 minutes.
Yeah, 17.
First of all, the title.
Yes.
This title, there has to be a story behind this title. What is it?
Well, you know, it actually came from a journal entry that I wrote a long time ago, and it was just that. It was just one page that said that, and I don't even remember writing it, but it is something that I've come back to a lot, and we were going to name it something like really short, and I was like, to my producing partner, Emily Harris, I was like, hear me out. What do you think about a title that's longer than the film? And we both kind of thought that it touched on the nebulous kind of quality that the film is exploring, of like that, like we try so hard to find who we are, and it takes so long, and it never stops. So the idea that you could like fail at being yourself is kind of funny, but that's, I feel like, what anxiety is, right? Is that like when we're not living by our values or living up to our expectations of ourselves, that we feel like we're failing, but really the reality is you are yourself in every moment, whether or not you're showing up the way you want to. So it's not really something you can fail at, but I think that idea of anxiety being like failing at just becoming is was interesting to me.
So essentially, what's the story that you're telling in your film?
Like on a physical realm, it's really about a person who is recovering from top surgery. So the film starts with them just leaving surgery and getting picked up by their mom and their partner, and they're back in their childhood home recovering, and with their mom and their partner taking care of them. And I really wanted to explore, I guess, on the more like metaphorical level of like when you're so excited for an experience. I think like as a trans person, it's really a privilege to get gender affirming care, and you're waiting for your name to get called, and you're, you know, waiting for your surgeon, and you're reading everything about it, and it actually is really fucked up, because then you get cut open. So it's like, who is excited to get cut open? It changes, right? Like, I think the experience of wanting something and then getting it when it's so, it's such an intense bodily experience. It's really about the character kind of coming down from the excitement of the idea of it and dealing with the reality of, like, it takes a long time to heal.
What I found really interesting was something that I'd never thought of before, but one of our senses, smell, because some of the characters keep referring to that.
Yes.
And I'd never thought of that before. Yeah. Okay, so this story, is it autobiographical? Is it fictional? Is it, you know, based from friends' stories?
It's like, I'd say like most of my work is like creative nonfiction, so it was based on my experience of getting top surgery in May of 2022.
For yourself?
Yeah, for myself. And it, yeah, I think when I got it, I was like really confused because it's a lot more, you know, this is something in the past 5 years that is like now people understand what top surgery refers to versus like a double mastectomy, just in terms of like trans visibility and terminology is so much more commonplace, but there's still a pretty limited amount of like conversations about what the reality of these things are. Like, I found like most of my anxieties went to Reddit forums, you know, like not surgeon websites. I struggled in the aftermath. And at the time I was having a more complicated relationship with my mom, but now we're, you know, very close. And we always have been close. But I think that transitioning in front of people is very vulnerable. And it feels really hard to be witnessed when you're not ready yet. You're still like, even though you've had the surgery, it feels like it's going to be a long road. Like, you know,
when you were going through that experience for yourself, did you think, you know, there's something in here, I'm going to use this at some point for my art?
I think in the first week, which is what the film really chronicles, I did not think about that. I was very, it all felt like this super nebulous, like murky kind of time where like days bled into night and you're not really pretty immobile. So
because you're recovering.
You're recovering, yeah. Exactly. And it's something you're like, oh well, I'm just gonna watch TV, read books and stuff, but it's quite anxiety inducing to not be able to do things for yourself and to be reliant on other people. And I think it was kind of more like later in the month as I was recovering, I started to realize like how my dependence on these two relationships of like my chosen like queer partner and family and then like my mom, like how uncomfortable it was. Like, I wanted help, but I didn't want to be seen as like helpless. Mm-hmm. And it's somewhere like later when I was kind of reflecting on the really anxious time that I'd had, because, you know, there's fictional events in the film, like that kind of,
there's a scene outside, yeah, when the character is sitting outside, mm-hmm, and hearing all the neighborhood kids and, yeah, the noises and all that sort of stuff. That scene to me was so, for me, it was profound because, you know, here's this person just sort of like, you know, outside breathing fresh air and just like, I mean, to me, this is how I read that scene.
Yeah.
And just was like, kind of like just listening and I'm hearing these, you know, these kids just like say whatever. And it's, yeah, like, it was interesting. It was, yeah, really interesting. Is this short a proof of, is it part of a bigger project?
It actually isn't. It's, I just was like, I want to make something. And it's a standalone. Okay. Yeah. I think it speaks to like films I want to make in the future about kind of like, you know, I really want to make a film with a trans person that's not just them in queer community, which is, mm-hmm, could be like a echo chamber in a great way, mm-hmm, where you feel, mm-hmm, supported, mm-hmm, and seen, but like what's it like to be put back in familial spaces, mm-hmm, that feel uncomfortable.
You're just a person who happens, yes, to be.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, that having that character of the mom and her, you know, she doesn't mean to like fuck up their pronouns and stuff, like she's just learning, it's just a new thing for her, and having them have to trust her at the end, and take them outside, like I thought that for me it was kind of like that release of control, where, and also just, yeah, like, go outside. Like, what does it say? Like, internet speak is, like, touch, go, touch grass. Like, when people are, like, way too in something. Okay. Like, when it's like, why are you dissecting this to hell? Like, go outside and, like, remember that we're, like, small in, like, this big environment. And I think that can be really humbling in the best way.
So you are a screenwriter. You're a director, a filmmaker. You went to school for filmmaking. When did you, was there a flashpoint? Was there a moment, maybe even a film that inspired you where you said, uh-huh, this is what I want to do. I'm going to be a filmmaker. Was there anything like that, a flashpoint for you?
Yeah, it's like kind of funny to think of now, but it kind of makes sense too. I probably recognized something early on, but when I saw Juno when I was like, I think 12 or 13, I went to the theater with my dad, and we went to, God, I don't think this, I'm not sure if this theater exists anymore, but I used to call it the adult movie theater, because, which now sounds like pornographic, but really what it was that my parents would take me to a like, theater in Yorkville that like always, like I remember seeing The Hours when I was like 9 years old, like with Nicole Kidman, and I was like, this is way too advanced for me, but then just like serious films we would go see there, and my dad took me to see Juno, and I was like, holy shit, like I want to make something like that, like something that felt like very familiar and nothing like you'd ever seen before, and also just like a distinct voice. And, like, mining more complicated relationships and dynamics. Mm-hmm. I thought that there was some, it was just so unique to me.
So that's what did it for you?
Yeah, weirdly, I was, like, I'm totally obsessed with that movie.
So, okay. Rainbow Country, it's a gay show.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gay. For shocker, I know. I know, shocker, I know. But for me, I am androgynous. I'm a mix of male, female energy. You use they, them pronouns. For yourself, are you gender non-binary? Are you trans? What's your, where do you fit on that?
I identify as non-binary, but I mean, I started testosterone like 7 months ago, which was like a very big decision for me. Top surgery was no question. I was like, I can't wait to get rid of these things. But I was like, I don't know. It's, for me, gender has been a very big like discovery process, and I kind of,
when did that start for you then? When did you start, you know, questioning things about yourself?
Well, I came out as a lesbian in college, you know, at NYU there's like a saying that's gay by May, and okay. I was actually late to that because I came out in second year, but it's like, it makes sense and it's true, and so that was like comfortable for me for a long time, and things started, I mean, you know, I felt really repressed as a kid because I always knew I was gay, and you know, it's not a very unique story, but just that feeling of like, oh, I don't know what, I cannot picture myself as an adult, like I can't picture what I'm gonna look like or do or anything, because I just didn't see anyone who looked like me or wanted what I wanted, and or I, if I did see them, it didn't feel attainable to me. But being trans was much more of a, I wouldn't say like a surprise, but I think it was a much deeper impulse that like kind of started to emerge as I started to see people close to me finding their identities, and I was like wait, we can do that, or like I can do that too, like it really, I think just like there's such a childhood kind of thing around being allowed to do something, and that like has stayed with me far too long, where I'm like, whose permission do I need to be yourself, you know?
So in regards to your journey, how far along are you in your journey?
I really don't know. I mean, I guess I came out as non-binary first year of COVID, very classic, you know, we're all kind of looking at the internet and being like, looking at ourselves and seeing what are we,
and then you started testosterone, you said,
last like 7 months. February, okay. Yeah, so it's been, yeah, it's, and I wouldn't be surprised if I ended up identifying as he, him, but it's always just like, for identification has felt more like pronouns has always felt like more for other people, because I kind of feel probably a bit more like you, where it's like I don't embody the like masculine profile and I don't embody the feminine profile. I can't call myself like a personality with legs. Okay. Yeah. So really it's just like I'm starting to look how I want to look, and mm-hmm. however people perceive me, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm trying not to put too much stock in.
Yeah.
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 That's what feels good to me.
I hear you.
Yeah.
Here's my last question for you. When audiences see, whether they see this particular short of yours or something in the future, when people see one of your films, what do you hope your audiences come away with? What would you like them to take away from your work?
I would like them to learn and feel, I guess, is that all human experiences are collaborative, including transition. So, I think that seeing that like there's no good and bad in people, but really just people trying to do their best or their worst, but whatever it is that it's just I want like a to really point to the nuance and three-dimensionality of people. Yeah, I guess that kind of thing.
Well said, well said. Yeah. Beck Pico, thank you for your time. Well said, well done, well filmed.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for being on the show.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Are you okay? I'm like really nervous. Are you nervous?
No.
You smell crazy.
Oh my god. That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so weird. I had no idea what I was gonna look like.
What do you think I was gonna look like?
Just like no goobs.
You'll be back tomorrow?
I want to go home. Just for like a few days.
A few days?
Yeah.
I can't do nothing with my T-Rex arms.
You know, who really wants to help?
Your mom wants to help.
That was my TIFF 2024 On Location interview with award-winning filmmaker Beck Pico. By the way, their short film, Are You Scared to Be Yourself Because You Think That You Might Fail, won the award for Best Canadian Short Film at the 2024 Toronto International Film Festival. Up next, Sweet Angel Baby.
Hi, everyone. This is Mark Tewksbury, Olympic champion, leader, humanitarian. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Figured you needed a top off.
Yes, my dear. It's cold enough to skin you.
Here's a woman who takes matters into her own hands.
If there's one thing I know about this town, it's that we are not afraid of a little hard work.
Woo-hoo! Melanie Oates, hi, how are you?
I'm great, how are you?
I am well. I have to say thank you so much for being here, especially to talk about your latest film, an award-winning film, Sweet Angel Baby. Let's start from the ground and build up from there. Talk to me essentially about the story that you're telling in Sweet Angel Baby.
Yes, so the story, I started writing it in 2014, so it was a long jump from writing it to making it, and now finally being able to share it with people. But the idea came from sort of two different threads. So the more surface thread was, I had an acquaintance here in Newfoundland who had a sort of similar Instagram account where she shared these like incredible self-portraits and had like hundreds of thousands of followers. And it was just really fascinating to me how, you know, living in such a small place, obviously everybody would know about it and see it and be talking about it. And then she would just go out into the world like as herself. I was just interested in like her urge to do it, but also like the boldness to do it, because for me, like, I wouldn't have been able to do that, you know? So that's sort of like gumption to be able to do it. And then more personally, in my early 20s, I started publishing some fiction, like some short stories and just like local magazines and stuff. And the people from the small town that I grew up in didn't react super well to it. They sort of saw, you know, the characters as literally me. And, you know, if they were like drinking or having sex or like being bad, they sort of then put that to me, and like their view of who I was tainted. And then it sort of changed my relationship with home for a while. That was the more personal side.
So Sweet Angel Baby is a film about small town identity politics, conformity, queerness, sexuality. Mm-hmm. You wrote this film, you direct this film, you just spoke about essentially where the story comes from and some of the inspiration behind it. But for yourself, it's one thing to have an experience or to have, you know, a friend go through something. But what gave you the idea to want to bring this particular story to audiences? Where did that genesis come from?
I think, you know, as an artist, I have this this sort of obsession with finding a way to make myself like as vulnerable as possible. And that definitely comes through in my writing of like, I'm always sort of trying to push myself outside my comfort zone to get to a place where I just feel like really raw and uncomfortable, and like maybe I won't be able to show this to people, maybe I wouldn't be able to share this because it just feels like, you know, so exposing in a way. But then I also feel like that's an indicator of when something is worthwhile, because that's what could be useful to somebody who's seeing it. Or like, you know, it's when we like really drill down into our humanity in that way that other people are able to like recognize themselves or relate, or maybe not relate and like see something from a new perspective. But I think that like, yeah, that that rawness of like myself is what I'm sort of always after. And I definitely felt that way when I started to think about this story.
So the main character, Eliza, has a secret social media persona. Tony, a female character, is essentially the town's out lesbian. Eliza and Tony are in a same-sex relationship of sorts. When you were now looking to bring this story to the screen, to cinemas, to an audience, did you, in those early days of getting this project together, did you ever face any pushback when it comes to telling a queer story, this kind of story? Any pushback against telling it at all?
No, I didn't actually, which I don't know if it was surprising to me, but it was definitely encouraging. That was never an issue for like collaborators or funders or anything like that. And even I was surprised that when I screened the film in Newfoundland last year at the Women's Film Festival, and a bunch of people from my hometown and my family came, and they were so open to it and like moved by it and supportive of me. And like, that was also shocking to me because of, you know, earlier experiences. It was kind of like healing in a way.
So this film, Sweet Angel Baby, it was filmed in Newfoundland. Mm-hmm. And you've got some great vistas in, yes, in this film. Is it fair to say that essentially Newfoundland is another character in this film? And if so, was that important for you to film this in Newfoundland?
Yeah, I would say it's fair to say it's a character. I actually, when I first started writing it, I tried to set it in like generic small town North America. Yeah. Just because from hearing about, you know, like saleability of films and, you know, from that sort of like business side of filmmaking, you don't want to pigeonhole yourself to like a place or what people might be able to relate to it, etc. And that didn't last very long. And then as soon as I set it in Newfoundland, it just like opened up this whole other like level and way into the story that I was struggling with before. And I think, yeah, the characters are so specific. The place is so specific. And yeah, it's that sort of, you know, thing that people say. It's like the more specific you can be, then the more general it is in a way, because more people can relate to it. And I think that that's been true in my experience.
So Sweet Angel Baby is getting a theatrical release across Canada. It's starting on the east coast of Canada and will make its way across the country in select theaters. For you as a filmmaker, especially for your second feature-length film, what does it mean to you personally as a filmmaker to have your film, your second feature-length film, be seen in theaters? What does that mean to you personally?
It's the best. I love it. I still see a lot of movies in theaters. Myself, it's my favorite way to watch a movie because I'm just, like everybody else, like so distractible. And when I'm in a theater, I just love the experience of just like giving myself over to a movie. Like, you're in the dark, you're not going to be looking at your phone, you're just here, and you have to sort of like surrender to the experience of it. And I really love that. And I'm excited for people to see it that way. And I mean, obviously, just to see like the cinematography and to hear the soundtrack and everything, like, it'll just be so good in the theater. And then, yeah, it's like the community aspect of it too, which just, yeah, it's my favorite way to see a movie.
The title. Okay.
Fight of the Fly.
First of all, so I saw this film last year at TIFF 2024, and I kept raving about it to people that I would come across. I'm like, oh, it's so good. You know, I kept stopping myself because I'm like, is it Sweet Baby Angel? Is it Sweet Angel Baby? Yeah. Sweet Baby Angel? The title, Sweet, because that's why I say it slowly, because I don't want to mess up the title, but Sweet Angel Baby.
Angel Baby, yeah.
The title. Is there a story behind this title?
Yeah, a lot of people say Sweet Baby Angel, which honestly either is fine with me. We would call it like in production Sav, just for ease, and then that's sort of like how I even remember it. I'm like, it's Amy. Yeah, so when I started writing it, like in 2014, around that time, like that was really sort of the Instagram lingo of how people talk to each other, you know, my sweet angel, my baby girl, like, you know, with all the emojis. And so that was sort of the initial idea. Then the other thing that I really like about it is how it's sort of very wholesome sounding in a way, but it's also like kind of sexy.
No, I've been thinking a lot about you lately.
I don't think you knew my name.
I've lived here your entire life. I know your name.
What's going on? You okay?
So she's hiding out, is she? You don't know?
What specifically are you talking about?
Okay, so Melanie Oates, you are an award-winning filmmaker. Sweet Angel Baby. Sweet Angel Baby is your second feature-length film. You've worked in television, you've worked in film, on short films. So for yourself, being a filmmaker, how did this come about for you? How did the love of film come about for you? Like, were you introduced to it by a family member? Do you have a favorite film that you got hooked on? How did this all start for you?
Yeah, it was sort of late in a way. Like, I grew up loving movies and watching movies all the time. But it never occurred to me as sort of a possibility of a job, or, you know, I didn't really know, like, what a director was, what their job was, or, like, even a screenwriter. And I sort of came to it through writing. I was always interested in writing, and then I took film studies class in university, which was not practical, just like watching films and talking about them, and then was writing some like short film scripts. And then at the same time, I started working on a TV show in the costume department, and yeah, just getting to be on set and watch people direct, and then learn about like what all the crew members are doing, how they all contribute. Yeah, that was like a great film school for me. But yeah, I had written a short film and I was going to try to get somebody else to direct it. And a friend of mine challenged me to direct it myself. And yeah, once I did that, that's it. I was off.
For you as a filmmaker, an independent filmmaker, what are some of the biggest challenges that you've seen time and time again? Because you've been behind the scenes, what are some of those challenges that you've seen time and time again that face independent filmmakers?
I mean, there are many. Like working with the small budgets that we often work with is super challenging. And the schedules that we work with is like very challenging. It's like almost impossible, you know, it's like this close to impossible. And then anytime you actually make a movie, it feels like a miracle that it happened. Yeah, those sort of like big practical things are a challenge. And then, you know, after the fact, making the movie accessible for people can be a challenge if you're, you know, an indie filmmaker who's relatively unknown with a low budget, and maybe you have cast that are not well known. Just making your work accessible to people. And I know from like friends of mine, you know, who've struggled with it's sort of up to other people, like whether you get into a festival or get picked up by a distributor, and you know that can be really sort of devastating then if you don't. So yeah, all those things are challenging. And then I think for me personally, just like always sort of trying to stay true to myself, my voice, push myself to just be more true to my voice, like with each film. Those are sort of like my personal challenges.
I mentioned this earlier, but in 2024, Sweet Angel Baby was part of the Toronto International Film Festival, TIFF. Mm-hmm. What was that experience like for you, being part of, you know, arguably one of the top three film festivals in the world?
Yeah, I would argue that. It was amazing. I'd been to the festival a few times, and I was part of the TIFF Filmmaker Lab in 2022, which was incredible. And, you know, as a Canadian filmmaker, I like dreamed of having my film play at TIFF. And yeah, the actual premiere was amazing. So all the people who came up to me after and connecting with them was super special. And then just from, you know, a career perspective, it's like everybody knows Tiff. Like, you know, you can say that anywhere and people have heard of it. And yeah, I've gotten like a lot of opportunities and interest and sort of, just more people interested in general, which has been really great and encouraging.
So also in 2024 at the Atlantic International Film Festival, the AIFF, you won for Best Atlantic Canadian Screenwriting. Mm-hmm. Best Atlantic Canadian Screenwriting. Winning that award for Sweet Angel Baby, what did that mean to you? What does that mean to you?
It meant so much.
Because you've been writing it since 2014.
Exactly. It's like I put a lot of work into writing it. But I have like the writing specifically acknowledged was really meaningful to me. And because, you know, it was so personal. And it did feel like a risk to me. And I did feel sort of like exposed and vulnerable in sharing it. And so to have it received that way meant a lot. That was a good day.
In 2025, Sweet Angel Baby opened the St. John's International Film Festival in St. John's, Newfoundland. What is it about this particular film of yours that connects with people, that is connecting with people, so that, you know, you won the screenwriting award, and in 2025, it opened the St. John's International Film Festival. What is it about this film that you think resonates with people?
I think people really resonate with the sort of identity theme, because, you know, even if you're not queer, I think so many people struggle with like finding themselves, being themselves, allowing themselves to change. And I think that's sort of that struggle people relate to. And I think really the performances, like Michaela and Elmaya and Peter, I think, and all the rest of the cast give such like beautiful, striking, honest performances that people just like really, really feel it, you know?
For yourself as a filmmaker, as an individual, this particular film, Sweet Angel Baby, is at the heart is telling a queer story. Mm-hmm. And for yourself, as a person, as a filmmaker, why was it important for you to tell essentially a queer story? Why was this important for you to tell?
I'm queer. I grew up in a small town very similar to Eliza's. And it was definitely something about myself that I really struggle with. And I didn't like really sort of have language for it at the time or like define it in that way. But I felt like there was something like off about me or like different about me that I needed to like hide and keep secret. And so that was important for me to talk about. And then, yeah, to have, there were a couple of times, like when I was a teenager, where people sort of like found out things about me and there was like a really intense reaction and like what that did to me and how that made me feel. And then I know that that's like an experience that a lot of people still have, even though, you know, we have come so far. In small towns and especially towns that are really isolated, it really is something that still exists and that people still struggle with.
Even more so today in current day times, it's, mm-hmm. you know, you think about politics.
Yeah. Yeah. It hasn't been linear.
How did you deal with things when it came to dealing with your queer identity and people finding out? Was it something that, you know, you shut down? Was it something that you tried to suppress? Was it something that you tried to deny? How did you deal with it? Because I know for me, like, when my sister said something to my mom, like, I just ran out of the house.
I definitely fully suppressed it and hid it until when I was 18, I moved to St. John's. And then, you know, when I was like 18, early 20s, and I was sort of in a new place, making new friends in a new environment, it was then that I was sort of felt safe to be more of myself. But yeah, I definitely wasn't, you know, I wish I had been sort of brave enough to do it back then. But yeah, I wasn't. And I think I also just didn't really fully understand it myself at the time.
Do you think and this is something that I often ask creatives, especially, you know, creatives that are part of the LGBT community, but for yourself, and this is a two-part question, but for yourself, do you think you're creating your art, and for yourself in particular, the films that you're making and that you're writing, do you think that you're telling those stories through a queer lens?
Good question. I guess I am, because I am. You know what I mean?
And it's all we know.
Yeah, and how can you do otherwise if you're trying to be honest or, or especially, you know, it's interesting to think about because, yeah, as I'm making a film in the fall that somebody else wrote, and queerness is not a subject, so I'm like, then is it still through the queer lens? I don't know.
You just might be queering that non-queer story in some way, shape, or form.
Right? Yeah.
And that leads me to the second part of that question. Do you think going forward that telling queer stories, telling LGBT stories, will be a focus for you, being a creative person?
Yeah, definitely. I'm also writing a movie called Some Kind of Way, which is a relationship drama, but the main character in that is a queer woman who has relationships with men and women. And I think, yeah, I'm interested in, you know, Sweet Angel Baby really takes queerness on, like, as the subject. But I'm interested in just having characters who are queer, like, existing in the world and the story, you know? So that's something, like, I'm looking forward to exploring more in the future, yeah.
Earlier I asked you about, you know, some of the challenges about being, you know, an independent filmmaker. But when it comes to this particular project for Sweet Angel Baby, for yourself, what's been some of the best parts about bringing this story to life?
People that I got to work with, I mean, working with Michaela and Elmaya, and Chris Mabley, the cinematographer, James Vanderwater, my editor, like all these incredible people, who are so good at their jobs and bring so much to the story, but also like really loved the story and cared about it. You know, cause you're sort of like, nobody can really care about it as much as you do. But they came pretty close. So yeah, that's been really special. And then, yeah, just sharing it with people. Like, people are so generous when they come up and like tell me like their personal stories. And that's really, really incredible.
Well, I have to say, Melanie Oates, well said, well done. Well filmed.
Thank you.
Thanks for
appreciate
your time.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Figured you needed a top off.
Yes, my dear. It's cold enough to skin you.
Here's a woman who takes matters into her own hands.
If there's one thing I know about this town, it's that we are not afraid of a little hard work.
I've been thinking a lot about you lately.
I don't think you knew my name.
I've been here your entire life. I know your name.
What's going on? You okay?
So she's hiding out, is she? You don't know?
What specifically are you talking about?
Eliza?
Or can you pretend to be someone you're not?
Do you think they were actually hooking up?
And he says they were.
What'd you do to her?
I was thinking about pressing charges.
For what?
Thought you had everyone fooled, didn't you?
What'd she think was gonna happen?
Pretend like you just then, like, move away.
Care?
No.
You need to go.
No, 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 please, please.
Not this round with me.
That was my interview for the new Canadian queer film, Sweet Angel Baby. By the way, on August 15th, 2025, the film started its theatrical run on the east coast of Canada, including Halifax, St. John's, Cornerbrook, and Charlottetown. It'll open in more Canadian theaters in the coming weeks, including Toronto, Winnipeg, Calgary, and Vancouver. So, keep your ears and eyes open for Sweet Angel Baby.
Hi, I'm Joey Lamar, best-selling author of Mambo Lips and Salsa Hips, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Taking us to hour two of Rainbow Country, I'll Tumble For Ya, Culture Club.
Algorithm-based